and welcome to another episode of GT Radio Conversations with Tino. I'm so excited today. I got a great guy on the show, a guy who's knowledgeable. He's been around, good guy, slick dresser, good golfer. What else do you want with life? Brian, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks for having me, Brian. You know, this is going to be a lot of fun. We've been talking about this for a long time. Can't wait.
Yeah. So you and I did a panel I think it was a week ago at Pechanga, and we got a lot of great insights. We got a lot of great people on that panel. And I wanted to veer off of those kind of questions and, you know, nuts and bolts, but I want to talk a little bit about your roots, because a lot of people that have been in the show has talked about where they grew up and how that shaped them in whatever business they wanted to get into for the rest of their life. Give us a little bit of an idea of where you grew up, what it was like, and, you know, who were your influences growing up?
Yeah, sounds really good. Well, first and foremost, that panel we did at Pechanga was fantastic. You did a great job moderating.
All right, great.
Not as
thank
easy
you.
As it looks. So just wanted
it's
to
not,
say thank you for
no.
taking care of us. It was a good time. So,
yeah.
So growing up, I grew up in a small town in central Wisconsin, about an hour and a half north of Madison, a little town called Nisita. It's a town of 773 people. You know, when I was growing up, there was no stop-and-go lights. You know, we didn't have McDonald's. I think we had a Subway growing up. But near a lot of the lakes in the middle of the state, a lot of hunting, a lot of fishing, a lot of sports around there. You know, farmland, you know, it's a dairy state, so you smell cow manure in the summertime. But it's a great little town. You know, we had a national wildlife refuge, you know, there with about 100,000 acres, something like that. But it was a good little town. And, you know, 773 people, you knew everybody. But a lot of people couldn't wait to leave. And I got to tell you, Tino, I can't wait to go back. Every time I get to go back, it's just a great feeling being around family and friends you grew up with. And I'm a small town guy at heart. So, you know, that's really what it was all about for me, is, you know, knowing everybody, a lot of comfort and all the stuff I loved, hunting, fishing, sports, and, you know, fun friends, maybe drinking the beer out in the woods once in a while, things like that.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Coming from a place like that, which is very rural, and you know, my wife is from Michigan, so she's from St. John's. It's about 4,000 people.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, for anybody that doesn't know Wisconsin, there's a lot of forest, a lot of farmland. You know, there's a lot of fishing and hunting. It reminds me of Canada, actually, when you go up north.
Exactly.
Who were some of your influences? I mean, your mom, your dad, the community. Who were some of the people that kind of, you know, built your foundation? And what were those messages?
Yeah, you know, so it was a pretty modest upbringing that I had, you know, very ordinary. I don't think there's a single thing I could tell you about my life growing up that you'd say, wow, that's extraordinary. But it was a nice upbringing, but, you know, very ordinary. So my parents really instilled a solid work ethic into me, you know, a good old Midwestern work ethic, and a clear expectation not to draw shame onto the family name. So, you know, those were very important influences, obviously. And, you know, my first job ever was making $3.15 an hour detasseling corn. I don't think many people, do you know, have you ever heard of detasseling corn, where you pull the stalks out of the top and it turns them into field corn? Yeah.
Wow.
You know, you go through all the cornfields every single row, and you pull up the tassels off the top, and it was a brutal job. You know, all the leaves on the stalks would cut your arms. You'd come across dead cows and animals and things like that. So it was very humbling as a first job, you know, to do something like that. So, you know, that was the first one. And after that, I worked for this little resort marina as a dock boy. So I would mow the grass, and I would do grounds repairs, and, you know, catch boats when they're coming into the docks, and pour gas and restock the coolers and the bar and things like that. So I worked for a guy named Irv Tesmer, back in New Lisbon, Wisconsin. And he was one of those guys I guess I really learned the most from when it comes to how do you treat people, both as customers and as employees. He always did it with a smile. He always looked you in the face. He thanked you for a hard day's work. He thanked his customers for coming in. And I think those are some of the qualities that I guess have stuck with me without even thinking about really why or how I kept them in my mind. But I've thanked him 1,000 times over the years. But he really was probably the biggest influence I had when it came to, you know, how do you work in the hospitality industry, and, you know, how do you treat people?
So he was basically, at the beginning, he was a major influence on your understanding of customer service, right?
Oh, huge influence. I mean, he was fun to work for, and, you know, he made sure that, you know, everyone was taken care of, both customers and his team. But, you know, he had that laugh. You could hear it across the lake whenever he was telling stories and holding court and chat with people. But you can learn a lot by watching somebody that knows how to engage people and show appreciation for them. So Irv is definitely that person, you know, for me, and I'm glad I got the opportunity to learn early on. You know, I started, I think, when I was 15, and I worked there for the next four summers, you know, into my first year of college. So it was a great way to learn about hospitality, but really just a great way to learn about people and how you should treat people.
Yeah, that's like the key to hospitality. When you were working there, what were your aspirations? Which direction did you want to go? Did you know at that point?
Well, you know, it's funny, you know, just like any kid, you know, when I was young, I wanted to be a professional baseball player, but I learned pretty quick that I ran out of talent for that at a pretty early age. But, you know, I didn't really have a clear idea, you know, at that time. I kind of wanted to go into wildlife management. You know, I still have a love for the outdoors. Also had interest in business. I've always liked numbers, and numbers have always made a lot of sense to me. But, you know, I didn't really know what exactly I wanted to do as a career growing up and in my teens and even in my early 20s. I didn't really know, but I always had that mindset of being elite. Now, whether or not I could actually ever achieve that or whether I had talent enough to reach that type of level, that was never something that entered in my mind. It was just a mindset that I always had. And I guess that's where I found some drive and determination to try and, you know, be the best that I can be, maybe not the best that's out there, but the best that I can be. So I really didn't have a clear understanding of what I wanted to do, but I went to college and did my best to try and stay in school. But, in college, you raise a little bit of hell. you hang out with the buddies that you have a lot of fun with, you know, I just went through the motions at that point. But luckily, at one point, the gaming career found me, which, you know, it finds a lot of people. Most of us don't actually go out looking for a career in gaming. It just kind of happens to fall in our lap. And once you get into it, you fall in love with it, and it becomes part of your DNA. And that's kind of what happened to me.
Well, let's talk about that. What did happen? How did it fall in your lap? Tell us the story.
Yeah, so going back to the college, I actually got kicked out of college three times. And it was because, you know, whenever I did go to class, I didn't go very often, but when I did go to class, I sat in the back of the room and, you know, you just try and get by because I was there more for the social aspect. I was having a lot of fun. And I had gotten a call from my biological father who still works for the Ho-Chunk Nation in Wisconsin. And they have the six casinos around the state. And he just said, you know, what are you doing? You know, what do you plan on doing? Now, at that point, I was bouncing at a nightclub. I was delivering pizzas for Domino's. And he said, why don't you come in and apply for a job, you know, being security. And at that point, you know, I was, you know, 22 or something like that. I didn't have my degree. And it just seemed like a fun thing to do. So I applied and, you know, went through the interview process. At that point, I thought security was about crowd control and all these things. Well, you know, how much crowd control do you have to do for 62-and-a-half-year-old grandpas and grandmas in Central Wisconsin? Not a whole lot. So I got to learn about the business that way. But, my first day was October 15th of 1995, and I was on the graveyard shift for a security team at a small casino back in Wisconsin. So that's actually how it started, and, you know, that's – what really got the wheels turning into motion and I paid my dues, I think, the right way, you know, and starting at the bottom and working my way up. But I can tell you one thing, I wouldn't change a thing about it. I like the roots that I have, and I think it served me well through my career.
Brian, what was the progression after the security job? And what were some of the things that obviously when people think about security, they think, you just stand around and whatever. But how you know, obviously you took your job seriously and you know, what was it that you learned in these low level jobs, and then what was the progression? How did you move up the ladder?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I didn't always take my job in security too seriously. We had a lot of fun, you know, back in those days. And, it, you know, it was a different game back then, and it was a small rural casino in Wisconsin. So not exactly, you know, the image that we all have today. But, you know, I was that guy that was always committed. And I lived about 45 minutes away from the casino. So I was one of the guys that lived the furthest away. But I was always one of the first guys that came in, especially in snowstorms and things like that. And whenever they had offered, does anyone want to stay and work a double, I'd stay and work a double. Sometimes they turned into triple shifts, which obviously we know we can't do that anymore. But, you know, I'd work, you know, the 24-hour straight shifts. And, you know, I just enjoyed being there. And the progression really started without my intention. If I had my way when I first started, I would someday become the security shift supervisor. That was my goal. I would know that I made it if I ever got to be the security shift supervisor. If I was lucky, maybe on the day shift. So it was the first couple of years that I really stayed in that position. And the first time I got an opportunity to move up was when I was filling in for one of my bosses. We had a manager's meeting, and when they'd go around the table, they would ask everyone, what do you think about this strategy, or what do you think about this initiative? And when they got to my seat, I would just tell them whatever the guests were telling me on the gaming floor, because I was on the front line. I got to listen to them all day. I got to talk to them and, you know, see what they liked, what they didn't like. So the manager started to think, you know, this decor kid might actually know what he's talking about. And the truth was, I was just giving answers based on what the guests were telling me. So that's really where it first started. And I got a lot of opportunities to grow in responsibility and be more of a decision maker and make an impact. So it was a fun way to go about it. And I didn't really look to grow in the business, but you just get opportunities when you show up and you're a team player and you take care of the guests. And I guess that's what happened with me. And they started moving me up.
So what kind of positions did you do during that period?
Yeah, it's a long and winding road. So from security, I actually went into marketing. And, you know, I'm a marketing guy. That's how I grew up through the ranks. So I did security for, I think it was like 2.5 years, and then went into marketing and was the advertising manager. And when we lost our entertainment person, I became the interim or acting entertainment director. And, you know, did that. And then I think we lost the marketing director. So they asked if I wanted to take on, you know, some of those duties. So, you know, did the same thing and really enjoyed, you know, being able to make an impact and working with a team and, you know, learning more about what makes the wheels turn in a casino. And, you know, did that and, you know, I decided to pursue some outside the casino work and went and worked for a radio station for a little while and had fun, but really saw that I missed the casino world and all the fun things that go into that. And I went back to school and, you know, I wanted to finish my degree because I saw that the positions I wanted, I couldn't get until I got my degree. And what do you know, this time I sat in the front of the class instead of the back of the class and actually went to class and, you know, finished my undergraduate degree in business and then came back in the director of compliance position and did that for the Ho-Chunk Group in Wisconsin, went out to Buffalo and Niagara Falls and did that for the Seneca Gaming Group. And saw that I was missing the operation and, you know, got recruited to go out and be the marketing director for a casino in Arizona up near Sedona. I'm sure you spent some time up that way. And, you know, did that.
Sure.
And at that point, you know, my boy was just an infant and, you know, he didn't have many contacts back home in Wisconsin where most of my family's from. So made a tough decision to head back to Wisconsin and went back to work for the Ho-Chunk Group so he could be around family. And I think I started as the hotel general manager when I first went back there. And then I went into casino shift manager. And then it was on to marketing director for the Ho-Chunk Gaming Wittenberg Casino and then the one in Nakusa. And when the GM of those two properties was let go, they asked if I would take on those responsibilities. And I thought, you know, there's no other way to learn the ropes and try this if you don't actually try it. So But I also wanted the protection of having my marketing director position to fall back on if things didn't work out politically or, you know, whatever. So I was GMing both properties and being marketing director for both properties. And I think I was getting paid $65,000 a year, you know, something like that. So it was a lot of work and a lot of time. But there's no other way that you can learn whether or not you can GM a casino until you actually try it. And Wouldn't change that, but after that, it was on to GMing for the Mohican North Star Casino Resort in Wisconsin between Green Bay and Wausau, if you know those little towns in Wisconsin.
Yeah,
and
I know,
then
I know
I
well.
That's right. You do business up there with those guys. After that, it was out to Firekeepers Casino in Battle Creek, Michigan. I got recruited to replace their soon-to-retire CEO. So I was out there for a little over 4 years, maybe 4.5 years, somewhere in there. And then, started talking to Snoqualmie and actually a number of great operations around the country. But Snoqualmie Casino, just outside of Seattle, it just had everything I'd ever looked for, from great team, great owners, responsible owners and ethical owners, and a great location. It's Seattle's closest casino and just a beautiful design, et cetera. So I took a long and winding road, Tino, to get to where I am today. But like I said before, I wouldn't change it. It's a great team and just a lot of fun out there. And if you spend time in the Seattle area, you just know it's beautiful. We're located, in the beautiful mountain valleys of the Cascades, and the views are stunning. Out my backyard, I have elk every night that come in. So it's just beautiful, gorgeous,
wow.
Great team, and I couldn't be happier. Long road.
That's great. Yeah. And the thing about it is, most people who are good at what they do in this business have tasted a lot of different positions, and it seems mm-hmm. like you've done that. Brian, what were some of the – moving up like you did and being in so many positions, what were some of the lessons, the most valuable lessons that you learned, and what were some of the challenges for you, making those transitions from, compliance and the GM and you know what I'm saying? Those are big leaps. What were the lessons learned and what were the challenges?
Well, I would say that the lesson learned, the most valuable lessons learned, were probably taking a genuine interest in my team and not just their team successes, but their individual successes. And, as the saying goes, a person that feels appreciated will always do more than what's expected of them. And I didn't know that early on in my career, but as I took more of an interest in their careers and mentoring them and making sure that they were successful, I started seeing not just the benefit for the team member, but I also started enjoying what I did even more. So I think that was probably the most valuable lesson that I learned. It wasn't something that was really taught or mentored into me. It was just something that you see the results and you feel better about what you're doing and you start doing more of the same thing, right? You enjoy it and you're seeing results. So that's probably the biggest lesson that I learned. When it comes to the struggles and the things that I had to learn maybe the hard way in moving up is really, I didn't understand politics when I was first in the business and how important they are and how unfair they can be. When it comes to politics and rumors, especially in tribal gaming, you don't always get your day in court to defend yourself against the rumor mill because you don't even know what they are. So it's so important to know what your politics are. And it's even more important to actively manage them because you just don't know, what perceptions are out there unless you're actively paying attention and putting out little fires before they become fires. They become fires, and you don't want to participate in politics, but you certainly have to manage them. So that's probably the biggest lesson learned. I wish I would have learned it earlier on in my career, but we all skin our knees at some point. And I think that they're valuable lessons. So I would say that that's probably the biggest lesson learned. Oh, are we still there, Tino?
Hello. Oh, sorry.
Oh, there
hey,
we go.
We dropped out.
Hey,
yeah,
we got you back.
Yeah, yeah. What I was saying was, we dropped out. Sorry. As I was saying was, when you move up into those more powerful positions, the politics becomes more prevalent. You have to understand that more, right? Than when you're doing
absolutely.
The lower level positions.
Mm-hmm.
That's when it comes into
play.
Yeah,
it's omnipresent.
Yeah.
Yeah, so tough, but so important to learn for anybody. And I don't think it's just tribal gaming; it's commercial gaming. It's every position out there. But you know, learning how to manage it is. I think there's a little bit more science and finesse to it than what meets the eye. But important lesson to learn. You know, you're going to skin your knees along the way, but always worth it, and definitely something that's a priority.
Let's talk a little bit about the business. You know, how it was 10 years ago and where we are now. Give us a little bit of a comparison.
Oh, boy, yeah. So 10 years ago, I guess that's 2008. So that's really when the recession, the Great Recession, was you know, still gaining momentum. And I think we were starting to recognize it wasn't just a little bit of a blip on the radar. We could see it was going to be something big and it was going to be powerful. So it really felt, you know, I think to an industry, I think we all felt like we got punched in the face. You know, we had always had growth year over year. And in 2008, you know, it was a matter of how much are we not losing in comparison to others. So I remember I was in Arizona at the time, and, you know, we look at the state gaming numbers, and I'm like, wow, the entire state's down 18%, but we're only down 6%. That means we're doing twice as good as what the rest of the state is. And it was really a different time, and, you know, it taught us how to, you know, find new efficiencies, and it really got us to a position where we had to be more disciplined in both our costs, you know, expenses and outlays, and how we, you know, evaluated ROI. We all thought we were geniuses before because we're always growing revenues, and it was kind of easy. But once we hit the recession, it was pretty tough. But, you know, where we are today, you know, we're in a great position with a strong economy and stable gas prices, and you know, everyone's setting record years year after year with both top line and bottom line revenue. So the position we're in today is one of continuous growth. You know, just like it's Snoqualmie, a lot of people are you know, engaged in revitalization of their casinos. There's easy access to cheap capital to reinvest in the property and reinvent yourself. So I think that's, you know, a huge difference in just 10 years. You know, 10 years doesn't seem like that long to go from the worst days to the best of times, but I think that's where we're at, and I think that's what makes the job so fun right now.
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of growth going on all over the place. It's really amazing mm-hmm. to see. Where do we go from here? What do casino executives and new operators need to look for and consider moving forward? How do they manage their casinos so they're prepared if something happens by 2008, right? Because, you know, we never know what's going to happen with the economy, with the world. What do they need to look for moving forward?
Yeah, so, you know, I think this is where a lot of us all differ in our approaches and in our beliefs about what the industry is going to be like, and, you know, what the revenue is going to be like, and, you know, what trends are actually going to become, you know, proven trends or proven directions for the industry. So I think it's a lot of the same in being disciplined and in reinvesting where it makes sense to reinvest. And when you've got financing that's available, that makes sense to you. You know, some want to take a position where they want to be debt free. Others want to leverage the financial position they're in and take on debt in a way that it makes sense to take on debt. You know, it's not every debt is the same, and it's not always worse than being debt-free. But I think it's all different that way. But one thing I think is important for us is to take more of a cautious approach when it comes to things like the millennials and skill-based gaming. You know, for the millennials, you know, the whole chase, and, you know, they're the next generation, and we've got to start cultivating, we got to start investing in them. You know, we went through the same fire drill back in the 90s when we started fearing we're going to lose all the baby boomers. So, you know, the numbers are going to start declining. Let's replace them with Gen Xers. So we invested into the Gen Xers. We changed our promotions, and we changed the way that we invested them. And the average age of the gamer stayed the same. The Gen Xers just weren't ready yet. And the same holds true with the millennials. You know, the cost for acquisition and the cost to maintain them is just too high. So they're just not ready yet. They will be someday. The games may be different at that point, but I think it's going to be a gradual evolution rather than the stop, drop, and roll that we've seen a lot of people get excited about. And I think the same thing goes with skill-based gaming. It's just not, in my opinion, It's just not aligned with what makes gaming exciting. It's fun, you know, winning something instantly in the current gaming environment. It's not grinding out a win, which is what the skill-based gaming feels a little bit more like. They're completely different. You know, the existing slots, your results are quick and fast. And with skill-based gaming, you know, it takes like a minute or 2 minutes to get through to the end of a game. So it's just not what the players value when it comes to the gaming experience. If they wanted to grind out wins, everyone would learn to count cards and play blackjack. You know, that's just not fun. That feels like work, and you know, you're doing math all the time. So as an industry, I think we just need to stay disciplined to what we know and, you know, leverage the things that we have seen that were proven over time. And as the industry evolves, you know, you evolve with it. But I don't think it's something that you want to go too crazy about. With millennials or skill-based games, it's, you know, just my opinion. I know that every market's just a little bit different, you know, when it comes to that. And everyone's, you know, appetite for risk is a little bit different. But, you know, for me, we've got a limited footprint on what we can offer, and we're gonna stay disciplined to what works, and we're going to take care of the existing customers.
Yeah, so what you're saying, it's interesting what you said about the skill-based game. What you're saying is that mm-hmm. sensation is long. You need this 1 or 2 minutes, whereas in gaming, when you roll the dice, you get that sensation. When you hit the button, you keep getting that sensation over and over. Is that correct? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, essentially, you know, I remember seeing something. It was either Global Gaming Business or it was a Casino Journal. Maybe it was one of the email subscriptions. But somebody had actually done a lot of time analyzing the difference between the two. And then, you know, with a slot machine, it takes you 6 seconds to get a result. Blackjack, you get 40 hands per hour, you know, whatever that number is. And even when I've been out to Vegas, like at MGM, and wanted to go out and try, you know, some of those games that they have, you know, at the back there, they take a long time. They take a long time to learn, you know, first and foremost. And, you know, the length of time it takes from the start to finish, it's just different. You know, slots and blackjack and roulette and, you know, all the traditional games we have, there's instant gratification. And, you know, there's not a lot of thought that has to go into it. But when it comes to the skill-based games, I think they're just a little bit different. And I'm just not buying into it. I know there's a lot of research into, you know, what the value is and what the next generation is going to value and what they want. But I just don't think it's aligned. And we'd have to reteach the players how to enjoy those games. And I think inject a little bit more randomness and high jackpots in those games rather than, you know, rely on them to work. You know, they don't want to grind out a win. They want instant gratification. I think that's the difference. But I know that opinions vary on that.
Yeah, it's of course everybody's got their own slant, but that's an interesting observation. There's a whole new breed of operators up there and executives coming up in the ranks. What is your advice to them as they navigate through the gaming business? You know, the young people coming up.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, we get to, you know, we're going to see them out at NIGA. You know, I'm going to be out there in Vegas in a couple of weeks. And, you know, you do a lot of the social events. You get to meet a lot of them. I got to tell you, you know, they're very impressive. From the ones that work with me, it's Snoqualmie Casino. And the folks that I know throughout the industry, they're just impressive as heck. And, you know, the things that really, you know, catch my attention with them is their ability and their speed and efficiency at accessing data and, you know, leveraging technology. Just their understanding of it, it just blows me away. It's just like watching, you know, you got a 9-year-old son, I got a 9-year-old son. The way that they can navigate a tablet or a laptop is just, you know, just mind-blowing. So the advice I would have for them is to ensure that data – that they have that easy access to is actionable and that the technology that they can get their hands on has a return on investment. It's tempting to chase those new things. It's tempting to chase all that data and think, boy, what could I do with this data? It's one of the things that Scott Saroy always says, you know, he talks about paralysis through analysis. And that's kind of what I think when somebody gets excited and they go out and they get all this data and they start putting in the pivot tables in a spreadsheet and, you know, they just spend so much time, you know, understanding what it is. And, you know, unless there's something that we can take action on with all that data, the advice to those folks that are so good at going out and getting it in this next generation is to not get too excited until you can see that you can actually do something with the data. I know it's tempting, and I know that it's fun to do the research, but without making an impact on the bottom line, the data doesn't matter. You know, it comes down to database testing and you're testing control and your A and B groups and, you know, really seeing what levers you can push and pull to change the bottom line. And, you know, the same thing with the technology. You've got to give it proper evaluation and stay disciplined. And I guess the overriding, you know, advice is don't fall in love with either of them until you see returns are better than what we've been using for traditional methods. But it's an exciting group to watch, and they're an exciting and fun group to talk to. But I guess that's the advice that I would have for them. They're all pretty smart, and they make me jealous with how good they are with technology and accessing data.
Oh, that's great. All right, let's take some questions.
Sounds good.
Hello, this is Tino Magnetta. Do you have a question for Brian? Hello,
hey, Tino,
can you hear
it's
us?
Angie Dobbs. Hi, Tino.
Hey,
Angie,
how are you?
From Rainmaker. Hi, I'm good.
How are you?
Hi, Brian. How's it going?
Good.
Good, thanks. Good, thanks. So, Brian, you were just talking about, you know, big data and, you know, analysis by paralysis, which we find, you know, obviously happens a lot. But, you know, there are, you know, really smart people that are out there that uncover, let's say, trends that can be happening. But let's say that the operation might not necessarily embrace what is happening with the data. Have you ever run into a situation like that? And if so, what did you do in order to make that change so that now, you know, these new trends became important and that, you know, you could really change your business by using them?
Yeah, that's an awesome question, Angie. So good to hear from you. You saw you just a couple of weeks ago, and sure we'll see you back down at NIGA here in a couple of weeks. So that happens quite
absolutely.
A bit. I think there's a couple of things that go with that. And one is, you know, do you have the right people with the right technology, and are they using the technology to the fullest capabilities that they can? And I think that you probably run into that with your users of Rainmaker, which is great technology if it's used properly and in the right hands. So the folks that don't fully embrace the new data, sometimes that can even be us old conservative guys where we just don't trust something new and we want to see results before we go all in and fully embrace it and start trusting it. But I think it all comes down to that test and control. Whenever there's something that comes forward with either new data or new strategies for me, I'll always tell the crew, let's run a sample test. Let's just take a percentage of either the database or something new that we're working on, and let's take a phased approach to it. Unless it's something that's proven and we have great references from other folks, let's try and test just a little bit of it and let's see how it works. If it works with a 10% sample, then we'll go to 30%. If it works with 30, you go to 50, and if it works for 50, then you're going all in with it. So I think that's probably my thoughts on that, but it works different with everybody, and I think it all comes down to their tolerance for risk and, you know, what's important to them in their business plan. Great question, though.
That's great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You, Angie.
Good to hear from you.
Okay. Let's put that caller here. Hello, this is GC Radio. Do you have a question for Brian?
Hey, guys. Michael from Catalyst. How are you?
Hey, good. How you doing, Michael?
Hey, Michael. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, you too. You know, I know you're coming recently, came across from Michigan, and, you know, we have some clients in both kind of in the neighborhood of both places. What have you found that since you've, you know, moved over from Michigan to Washington, you found the biggest differences?
Yeah, great question, Michael. So, you know, for the most part, gaming in Michigan versus Wisconsin, New York, Arizona, and Seattle, it's all kind of the same. But the thing that really has jumped out to me is our win per player in Seattle. It's significantly higher than all the markets that I've worked in. And even the bus patrons, it's almost double what I've experienced in all of my other properties. So the win per players have been substantially different. And it's the same game. They're the same types of games. You know, we're more lottery based here for slots, but it's the same experience on the slot machine. But to see that level of win per player and even the win per unit for the number of machines that we have, even our auditors come in and say, boy, you, you guys really do exceed not just the market, but you know, pretty much the region when it comes to both of those particular metrics. So that was a cool thing for me to see coming in. It makes part of the job a little bit easier, and knowing that you don't have to acquire as many new players as what you might have to in a different market, because the win per player is so high. But cool thing to see. Nice surprise, you know, for a change. You know, sometimes you get surprises. They're not great ones, but the ones that we got here, they're great surprises, and makes the job all that much more fun. But great question.
It sounds like a good problem to have. Thanks, Brian.
You got it.
Michael, do you have another question for Brian?
How do you feel I know you're still looking for some help in the marketing area. How do you feel things are hunkered down in the interim?
Oh, they're actually fantastic, Michael. So we're actually chat with two. They're pretty powerful names, you know, from the Vegas market that are both looking at coming up and joining us. So we may be announcing soon who that chief marketing officer is going to be, but excited for final conversations there. But until then, you know, we got a great team at Snoqualmie. We got great owners, and the team's long tenured there with a lot of smart people. And we haven't quite finished the books for March as of yet. You know, it takes a little while to do that, but by all metrics, it looks like we have had the best month in our entire history. And it's going to be close to, I think, a double-digit increase over the second-best month we've ever had, I think, in top-line and in bottom-line revenue. So it's also the best quarter we've ever had, and we're on pace to smash the all-time record for the year. So we're in good shape. We've got great team players, and we got great owners, and we have great guests. So things are in good shape.
Good, good. Good for you. It's great to hear. Thanks, guys.
Sounds awesome. Good. Thanks, Michael. Take care. All right. Let's see here. We got hello, this is GT Radio. Do you have a question for Brian?
Aloha, it's Michael Ka'ahanui. How's it going?
Hey, hello. Another
hey, Michael.
Another person from Seattle. The Seattle Invasion.
Well, obviously, welcome to the neighborhood. It's another sunny day here in Seattle. With only about 3 to 4 weeks of the rain, so that's good. Hey, just a quick question for you, Brian. You know, obviously, you know, you've had some great experience out there, and now you're coming into a new environment. I got two questions. One, you know, anytime you're coming in as a new person, you know, you're cognizant of what type of change you want to bring to the property and how you want to implement that. You know, what's your philosophy kind of regarding, you know, culture change and you know, for you know, all groups that you have to work with, meaning team members, guests, and even ownership for some time?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, with the record year that we had in 2017, Michael, you know, anybody that comes in, you know, should come in with a conservative approach and saying, you know what, things are in pretty good shape here. I don't want to upset the apple cart with any crazy new initiative. So nothing crazy coming forward from a culture standpoint. But one of the things that's important for me, and I think for every organization, is to have trust in your chief executive. And, you know, it goes without saying that that's what should be there, but it's something that's not always there. So, you know, for the new guy coming in after, you know, what they had for a record year in 2017, I want to make sure that I came in and instilled a level of trust, you know, in me and in the position in the office that I brought to the table. But, you know, making sure that we're all committed to the same thing, we stay disciplined, and, you know, put the team first. You know, they brought us the best year we ever had, and I think we need to step up and show our appreciation for them, because they do the heavy lifting for us. I know you're a leader that puts your team first, and I think that we're pretty aligned when it comes to those things. Is, you know, thanking the people that do the heavy lifting for us, especially in a record year. So that's I guess what I brought from a culture and you know, a theory of, you know, accountability and taking care of the right people.
That's great. And then the second thing I always have, and it's always interesting right now, I think everybody, not everybody, but, you know, when we have these, when we go to all these conferences, you know, we all chit-chat, and we've talked about how well the economy's done and how successful many of the properties are, you know, record years, record quarters, record months. You know, as the marketing guy, I always love to take credit, but I always tell them, I'm one of the few I'm one of the few marketing guys that's telling my CFO, hey, it's not all me, right? There's more mm-hmm. to it. I can't attribute for all of it. How do you kind of counterbalance against the expectation of success?
Yeah, I think you are a unicorn, Michael, in that you're the marketing guy that doesn't take all the credit for the successes that we all have. So, like you said, this is happening across the country. It's not just our market up in Seattle. It was the same thing we had in Michigan, and, the numbers continue. It's across the country. Everybody's in great shape. But, the thing that's important to me is, from a leadership perspective, is making sure that there's enough credit to go around for everybody. You can never thank people enough. That's why I go on to the graveyard shift. I thank the graveyard crews. I spend my time, thanking the hosts for, what they're doing. And, they take a lot of lumps from the VIPs when they go through, one of their players goes through, bad beats, et cetera. So, making sure there's enough credit to go around, I think that the marketing department, for my property and, certainly for your property, I know things are going very well for you guys as well. Marketing does deserve a lot of credit. Just like slots do and just like table games do and, even compliance and facilities and the departments that aren't revenue generating, because I think everybody's got a hand in it, from keeping the guests happy and putting smiles on their face for faster transactions, more efficient service, better service, et cetera. But I'm not one to be stingy with giving out praise. And I think whether it's in a record year or it's in a tough year, you got to thank the heck out of the staff and, show appreciation for them, because, like I said, we're aligned on this. They're the ones that make things happen. So, great economy, crappy economy, they make it happen. That's my opinion, anyway.
Good point. Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Good to hear from you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for calling in. Thank you
Aloha.
So much. Aloha.
Aloha.
Yeah.
Love his.
Well, he's Hawaiian, so yeah. And I don't know if you know this, but Mike both worked at the Flamingo back in the late 90s, and that's where I met them first.
Oh, no kidding.
And they worked with Golly at the Flamingo. So
Golly,
Michael Glauser, and Mike Kay, who just left, got off the phone here. They were the team that I worked with at the Flamingo when I was their support digital agency. Back in the '90s, so we're all sort of know each other, and they all happen to call at the same time. So that's really cool. They're
very
great guys.
Cool. Love
all
it.
Right,
like it.
Let's move on here and see who else we have. Hang on a sec. Hello, this is GT Radio. Do you have a question for Brian?
Yes. Hello, this is Michael from Metadata. How are you guys doing? Is this a Michael line?
Good. This is a Michael line. We've
like
had the third one in a row.
I'm in the right line.
Thanks
I saw the sign.
In,
it said M. Hey, knowing that you're working up near the border, I'd love to hear your take on the differences in the marketing between U.S. and Canada, not only in, let's say, time to just different styles of marketing on each side of the border.
Boy, Michael, that's a good question that I wish I had more experience and background on. So I worked near the border a little bit closer when I was with the Seneca Group out in Niagara Falls, obviously being, I could hit a golf ball across from America to the Canadian side there. But I wasn't in the marketing team there. But over here, so where we're at, I think it takes around 2.5 hours to get to Canada from Snoqualmie. Even though we're Seattle's closest casino, it's still a long drive up there. And it's not reflective of the number of miles. When it comes to rush hour, I put Seattle as a close number two to that L.A. traffic. So, that 2.5 hours could be a little bit misleading. But, our market reach, as you expect of a regional operation, extends, pretty far. But we really keep our main efforts and our focus on the major population centers that are within that 60 to 80 mile drive. And we have a lot of battle zone areas, in between there. But I wish I had more information on how to compare the American versus the Canadian marketing tactics. I don't even think I've seen a loony or a toonie in about 10 years. So I couldn't give any information on that, but always looking to learn. So if we run into each other at Niagara or another conference, I'd love to hear what you have to say about it.
Nice, thank you. I'm actually wondering, you know, when you have a lot of campaigns going on, and you know, most campaigns that you do in marketing have a pretty good draw response rate, and you mm-hmm. have so many campaigns, but the execution time to keep them all in sync and to keep them from overlapping and to make sure they go out on time, do you find it's difficult to get your first tiered mailer out on a guest's first visit to get them to bounce back?
Yeah, you know what? I think it all comes down to processes, Michael. You know, it can't. You know, when you're new to a property or you're new to marketing in a leadership position, you know, getting to that point where you have things aligned, you put them into a calendar, and you want to balance them out so you're not layering your different offers, et cetera. You know, that can be challenging. I think from a new guy's perspective, either coming in new to marketing or coming in new to the property, but you know, once you're established, I think it's all part of, you know, your processes and the timelines that you have. And, you know, we have certain triggers that take place, you know, after a guest first visits, and, you know, when we haven't seen them for 2 months, we have another trigger that goes out. Say you were here on January 1st, but we haven't seen you in X number of days. Here's a little reminder. We like you and we want you to come back, and we know you have options, but here's something that we want to give to you. So I think it all comes down to processes, Mike, and if you've got them in place and they're tried and true and they're proven, that it's not too confusing. And, you know, we've got a great team, so it's not something we really run into many challenges with. But I know that some out there do, and I know there's help out there if they need it.
Nice. Well, it's great to hear your experience and your traveling. And, you know, what's interesting about the position you're in, and you described it in your journey to get here, is the musical mm-hmm. chairs that you end up living in when you move around. There's a whole bunch of people moving from property to property. It's an amazing process. And, you know, it is like a musical chairs, and it's great that you've found such good connections on your journey. And I'm just happy for you on that.
I appreciate that, Michael. It certainly is a small industry where, you know, we all know each other, and obviously we all stay in touch, et cetera. But, it's been a great journey. You know, I'm sure just like yours, you wouldn't change any piece of it, because even the times that weren't great, you know, they teach you the things that are important to you. And even when there's not great times, sometimes it leads to the best of times. And, you know, I'm certainly in a place where I couldn't be happier. So I agree completely.
Nice.
And look forward to catching up with you.
Thank you. Well, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Michael.
Show,
really
guys.
Appreciate it.
Right. My pleasure.
Yeah.
No
take
problem.
Care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Good question.
Can we find another Michael? Is there another one out there?
Yeah.
It's got to be, right?
mm-hmm. That was like three in a row. That's funny. All right. Hang on one second.
mm-hmm.
Hello. This is GT Radio. You have a question for Brian.
Would you be talking to me?
Yes, I am talking to you.
Hi there, Tino. It's Jack here. Hi, Brian, from No Butts International, Melbourne-based.
We hey, how
last
are you?
Week. I'm doing great.
Hey, how you doing,
we're,
Jack?
Good to
hear from you. I'm doing fine, mate. We're just relaxing a little bit after our pretty intensive trade show, because we came a long way for it. But
sure.
I just wanted to make a comment. Sure. You made a little point earlier on, and thank you for your interview. It's been very educational.
Thank you, Jack.
Putting small fires out before they become large fires, which for obvious reasons resonates very, very closely with us.
Mm-hmm.
But with that, I'd like to talk about, you know, what we do. We are amazed at the Indian gaming casino industry in the United States. We're Australian-based, and as you guys know, we've in the last year or so started, you know, moving into supplying casinos across America, and it's been an absolute epiphany for us that these places even existed, because you hear about Las Vegas and Atlantic City, but no one apart from people in the United States and maybe Canada understand or appreciate the enormous casino industry based on Indian land and run by what do they call it, indigenous people, as we call it in Australia. And
yes.
I'm just wondering, mm-hmm. seeing all these incredible casinos that are massive, huge, one after the other, and they're all beautiful. How mm-hmm. big can the industry get? I mean, what do you do? Do you just keep adding rooms to hotels and banging in extra machines? But it's just quite awe-inspiring, the size of the industry. And just curious, what else can you guys do to perpetuate growth in the industry?
Yeah, you know what? That's a great question, and I love hearing it from someone that's from Australia. I know you have a very robust market, you know, down there with your operators there. So I don't know what you know about our tribal industry here, Jack, but there's around 200 and I think it's 240 different tribes. Maybe it's 230 tribes that operate around 450, maybe even 470 casinos at this point. But you know, over $30 billion a year in revenue. So it's a pretty big industry. So, well, how do we expand? How do we grow? So some of that comes down to the laws that regulate what we can do and where we can do it. Obviously, we have to be located on indigenous land that's either reservation or land that's held in the trust. So sometimes we are restricted on our footprint on what we can do as far as expansion. That's one of the things that we have a challenge with in Snoqualmie, you know, just outside of Seattle. We have a pretty limited footprint in what we can do. So we got to make sure that when we do look at either an expansion or, you know, changing the layout of the floor, it all comes down to revenue per square foot and profit per square foot and what it costs to get that. But it always depends. You know, for us, we're looking at the opportunity of expanding. You know, we're doing a feasibility study on adding a hotel to the property. And, you know, once you add a hotel, you can get your VIPs to stay for a day and a half instead of just one day when they come out and have a little bit more time and time on device, et cetera. But it all comes down to what you have available for space. And, you know, we just came from Pechanga where we had the pleasure of meeting for the first time. And, boy, if we had the footprint that they had and the number of people in the area that they can detract from, that would be a lot of fun. They've got an impressive operation down there. But Snoqualmie's, you know, very much the same and sophisticated operation and great crew and great location, clean, classy, and close to Seattle. So we're happy with what we got. That's for sure.
I was going to say, you know, over the last few years, everybody's seen the movie Casino, where throughout the movie they're going less from gaming into, you know, they're almost turning into Disneyland for adults and putting in roller coaster rides and all that sort of stuff. With regard to your, you know, land constraints or, as you said, your footprint, is that something you would consider to sort of bring adults in by entertaining the kids?
Yeah, so each market's different on that, Jack, and you know I've had things like the Kids Quest, where parents can drop their kids off and they pay like up to $8 or $10 an hour to have the kids watch and entertain. They have games and video games. They have pizza and hot dogs and all these things. So it works differently for everybody. It doesn't work for everyone. You know, some of the things that some of these feasibility study folks will bring to the table is, you know, bowling alleys, movie theaters, and you know, all these complimentary amenities that can either extend time on property or allow their kids to go and, you know, watch a movie or play, you know, bowl or, you know, go to a video arcade or whatever. But unfortunately, that's not something that we have enough space to evaluate. But some markets, I think it works great. You know, we had a bowling alley. I think we had 22 lanes at my casino in Arizona. And, you know, we even had Snoop Dogg come in and he rented the whole bowling alley so his kids could, you know, coming in bowl and have a private time there. So it's different for everybody, but you never know which one's going to work for you. You know, it just depends on the populations you're drawing from and the priorities you have and, you know, the space you have to work with. But cool question. It's a fun one to talk about for sure.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking that, you know, if you – what do they say in that movie? If you build it, they will come. And if you guys bang in a nice big hotel like, you know, the guys at Pechanga have, it's not just going to be the adults, they're going to bring their kids. So I was kind of curious to know, what do the kids do while the parents are having some fun gaming? Because as good as your imagination is what will happen.
Yeah, I great, Jack, great question. Go ahead, Brian.
I was just going to say, it just kind of depends on your market position, where you're at, and where, you know, what kind of folks you're drawing from. You know, there are some casinos that have, you know, a lot of retail space around them where it's not just, you know, gaming in the middle of nowhere. A lot of our gaming operations are kind of out in the middle of nowhere, and they take a little bit of drive to get there. So, you know, it just depends on where they're at and how many people they have to draw from. You know, you don't build a church for Easter Sunday. You got to make sure you have sustained, you know, traffic to come through, and that's whether it's, you know, 12-year-olds and 18-year-olds or 35 and 55 and 65. I think it's all a little bit different for each market, but – fun to talk about, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I wish you all the best. It's been nice meeting you both. It was great meeting you guys at Pechanga. And look forward to talking to both of you soon. And best of luck.
Thanks so much, Jack. Take care.
Thank you.
All right. Great, great, great questions. Let's see what we got here. It looks like you're generating some good good action here, which is always always good.
You bet. Great question.
Yeah, let's try this one here. Hello, this is GT Radio. Do you have a question for Brian? Hello? Can you hear us? This is GT Radio. Looks like we have a bad connection. Can you hear us? Hello, hello. We can't hear you, so we're gonna come back to you, okay? Because right now we can't hear you, and there's a 10-second delay, so that's why we waited a little bit. Can you hear us? No, looks like they have a bad connection. We'll come back to that one.
All right, on. Sounds good.
All right, let's try that one, yeah. Okay.
Hello, hello.
Hello, this is GT Radio. Do you have a question for Brian?
Oh, hi, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening, how are you?
Good, good. Just a question. When you arrive at a new casino, what are some of the things you do the first couple of months on the job?
Yeah, great question. So as we travel the industry and transfer to different properties and take on new challenges, et cetera, as one of the callers said earlier, it's a pretty small group, and we take on a lot of different properties. So I would say I'm a typical casino gypsy. I've worked in a management capacity at 12 different casinos. I think it's 5 states now. But what's always important to me is getting in and getting to know the team in the first 60 to 90 days, building that trust with them to let them know I'm there for the right reason. I'm going to take care of them, and I'm going to make sure that we celebrate the successes and we don't do anything other than learn from the mistakes that we make. So I think, you know, that first 60 to 90 days is important to, you know, build the trust of the team. And I think the other piece of it, you know, at the same time is important is learning that you're becoming part of a team. You know, they're not joining yours. You're joining their team and learning, you know, what they do as far as what works best in their market, because they've been there. You know, it's Snoqualmie. I joined a team of 1,000. They've been doing it for 10 years. And, you know, for me to come in and want to try and change anything would be silly. So I earn their trust, and I see what's important to them. And I hear the stories from them about what's worked and what hasn't worked. And I think that's always been important for me is, you know, the first 60 to 90 days is, you know, earn that trust and learn what works well for them and what they enjoy about their career. Great question.
Perfect.
Though.
Right, sort of like a greet and meet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To know people.
60 to 90 days.
Did you have any?
You got it.
Did you have any other? Yeah. Did you have any other questions for Brian?
Yes, please. You talked a little bit about millennials and how you are not really chasing them. Is there another sector that you are cultivating?
Yeah. So that's actually a question that I don't think I hear often enough. So, you know, a lot of people fall into either the camps where, yes, millennials are the next thing. We need to spend and invest in them and do what we can to cultivate them. And there's other people, which includes me, is saying they're just not ready yet. They're going to be gamers someday in the future, whether they play traditional slots or tables or skill-based games or something like that. You know, it's somewhere way down the road. So I don't hear the question often enough is, if you're not chasing the millennials, who are you pursuing next? And in my opinion, and we all have different opinions on this, I think it's just that next group of gamers that are going to mature into the age where they are going to be your typical gamer. So the example that I give is that same one I gave, if you were listening earlier, about in the 90s, we thought all the baby boomers were going to start dying off and declining in their frequency and trip behavior, et cetera. It's got to be a matter of when people are ready. So with millennials, you know, they have so many different entertainment options. They go to concerts, they go to house parties and raves and, you know, baseball games, football games, you know, everything. They've got 50 different things that they do. Once we all start getting older, we don't like you know, going to crowded places. We don't like beer getting spilled on our favorite shoes. And, you know, we don't like to be in a lot of crowds and loud, crazy places. So the number of entertainment options for us gets a little bit smaller every single year, every 5 years. And, you know, to me, it's just a matter of getting into that that next group that's going to be ready to be the core demographic for the casino, which is, you know, the 55-plus, predominantly female. So it's, you know, going down to that next group. It's that 50-plus and the 45-plus and, you know, male or female doesn't matter, you know, but it's predominantly female still. So I think it's just that next group that's going to be coming up where they just limit their entertainment options and casinos become more appealing to them.
Right.
Good question, though.
That's
like
great.
It.
Excellent.
Yeah, thanks. That was a great
thank
answer.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, some great questions. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think what we take away from this interview is just your tenacity and like Mike Hempel said, the musical chairs and the weaving road. But mm-hmm. it's like you said, even when you were a security guard, you took double shifts. You came in early, even though you lived 45 minutes mm-hmm. away. So, you know, the old secret of hard work still works. It's still key,
agreed.
Right?
Agreed. Agree completely.
I mean, I'm
no
sure you're working just as hard today, if not even harder.
You got that right. Long days, but they're fun days, you know? You get to deal with a team, and, you know, it's a lot of fun, especially when you're winning. And right now, Snoqualmie Casino is winning in spades.
That's great. And it's largely a lot to do with you and your entire team. Michael,
I appreciate that.
Sorry, I got three Michaels, so I'm like stuck with
too many Michaels.
Brian,
man.
Thanks
that's
so much
okay.
for being
you call me Michael.
Too many Michaels. Yeah, Brian, thanks so much for being on the show. This has been absolutely fantastic, and looking forward to seeing you at my guest.
It's a pleasure, Tino. Thanks for having me on, and look forward to seeing you.
I'll talk to you soon.
All right, take care, my friend.
Bye bye.
Bye bye. Bye bye.
All right, that was great. Brian is. Wealth of knowledge and great leader. So I've got continuing on. We had Lauren Westerfield on from Stations. She kicked off the Wonder Women of Gaming, and on April 19th, again at 5:30 Pacific time, we have Suzanne Drought. She's the CMO of Foxwoods, but she has had so much experience in the gaming business, starting out. You know, in Vegas and then moving all over, and she's been in the business many, many years, worked with many, many people I know, and it's just going to be a pleasure having her on the show. So that'll kick off our second leg of Wonder Women of Gaming, and then I think we have six or seven women lined up after that, really really great women in the casino business. Remember, there's always someone who's got a story to tell. You just have time to listen to it. Thanks so much for listening, and you all have a great evening. Bye-bye.